Thank you, Mr. Ortega. Our next speaker is Michael Avery. Michael Avery is an associate professor of law at Suffolk University Law School in Boston, where he teaches evidence, scientific evidence, constitutional law, and individual rights. He is co-author of the Handbook of Massachusetts of Evidence, 7th edition, the leading treatise in the area. Avery participates actively in continuing legal education programs at law schools across the country. He was a trial attorney for 28 years, most recently at Perkins, Smith, and Cohen in Boston, and is considered one of the country's leading civil rights lawyers. He is currently president of the National Lawyers Guild, and Avery is a 1970 graduate of Yale Law School. Welcome.
Thank you. Well, thank you for having me here in New Hampshire. It's a pleasure to come up to New Hampshire and talk to people because I know that the spirit of liberty is strong in New Hampshire and that people in New Hampshire believe in their freedom and are prepared to fight for their freedom. And I want to start out with a few questions of my own, similar to the questions that the other speaker asked. I want to know how many people in the audience think that we as Americans have a right to go to the library and check out a book without the government knowing what we're reading. I'd like to know how many of you think we have a right to engage in a credit transaction or a banking transaction without the government knowing whether we owe anybody too much money. How many of you think if you get arrested and you're held in a jail, you have a right to talk to a lawyer about your problems? And how many of you think you have a right to talk to that lawyer in secret without the government listening in? How many of you think that if the workers in some place of work choose to do so, nobody makes them, but if they choose to do so, they have a right to join a union? And how many of you think that you have a right to send an email or talk on the phone without the government listening in? Now, there's one thing that I agree with you about, sir, and that is when people break the law, when they violate the Constitution, when elected officials lie to the American public, when they make up weapons of mass destruction, when they make up a connection between a country and Al-Qaeda that doesn't exist, when they drag us into war by lying to us and to our elected representatives, I'd like to know how many of you think that elected officials who do that should be driven out of office? These are very, very serious times. Make no mistakes about it. We are very close to looking at the end of the American experiment in democracy. Every regime that has ever existed in the world from the Roman Empire on down has had a certain lifespan. And we have been arrogant enough and hopeful enough in the past to think that our American democracy would go on forever. But that's not going to happen automatically. There are powerful forces in this country that are threatening our democracy in some very important ways. And I want to talk about that. Now, I know a lot of people in the room already know a lot about the Patriot Act and know a lot about what the government has been doing since September 11th and before September 11th to compromise our constitutional rights and to compromise our civil liberties. And so I'm not going to go into detail about a lot of things. If people want to know about particular statutes and particular provisions, we can talk about that in the question and answer period. I want to talk more about the nature of our rights that are being compromised. And I want to focus on four freedoms that I think we have. One is the freedom to remain at liberty unless there's probable cause to believe that a specific individual has committed a crime. The second is the right of people to be free from restraints on their liberty unless there is particular suspicion regarding that individual person. The third is the right to privacy. And the fourth is the right to free speech. And what guarantees these freedoms for us across the board since 1803 and the Supreme Court case of Marbury versus Madison, what has guaranteed these things to Americans is judicial review. And I have to say that contrary to what the Assistant United States Attorney said, we have not retained the same approach toward judicial review since the Bush administration came into power that we had before that. The Patriot Act and the other amendments to our previous laws have watered down the concept of judicial review. Yes, it's true that before they get a sneak and peek warrant before the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which is, by the way, not a real court. It's not in a courthouse that you can walk into. Defense lawyers like myself are not permitted to appear there. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court is, in fact, on the sixth floor of the Justice Department in Washington. The only people who get to address the judges of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court are prosecutors. And the first 14,000 warrants that the government requested from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court were granted without exception. Didn't turn the government down once, this so-called court, these so-called independent magistrates. And finally, they came out with a report. Their one published decision in the whole time they'd been sitting was a decision they came out with to say, we have discovered that government lawyers have been lying to us in cases. And they documented at least 75 cases where the government lied to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. And what did they lie about? When the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court was enacted, its purpose really was to catch Soviet spies and other agents of foreign powers, not to be used against ordinary Americans or even immigrants who happen to be legally in the United States. And so there was a provision in the law that when the government sought to get a warrant from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which was much easier than getting a warrant from an ordinary court, that they had to show that the principal purpose of the warrant was some foreign agent, the illegal activities of some foreign agent. And that's what they lied about in these 75 cases that the court itself documented. They lied about whether they were really going after some foreign agent. Said they were, but actually their purpose had to do with domestic issues. What does the Patriot Act do? Makes it unnecessary for them to lie anymore. That's how we fix that problem of the government lawyers lying to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. The Patriot Act says now interest in a foreign agent only has to be a purpose, a significant purpose. Not the purpose, a significant purpose. And so these incredible tools that were designed for use against foreign spies can now be used with regard to domestic law enforcement. I mentioned probable cause before. Most people know that in order to arrest somebody or in order to search somebody's private places, by the way, our private places, the nature of the private places we need to worry about protecting has changed dramatically. Used to be at the time that the barons gathered at Runnymede in England, they were concerned about a man's home as his castle. But now a person's home is no longer his castle. A person's home is just an anteroom to a vast network of rooms, some of which are virtual rooms that don't even exist. They're out there in cyberspace. They're records that are maintained by educational institutions and hospitals and banks, and libraries, and financial institutions. That's where your castle is today. Government is really not too interested in what you have in your house anymore when it wants to spy on you. It's interested in what's on all these other rooms, these virtual rooms. In order to conduct these searches, you're supposed to have probable cause, but the Patriot Act waters that down. So that mere certifications that the government is interested in some terrorist investigation, and terrorism being defined extremely broadly, is sufficient. We discovered in the 60s and 70s that the government was engaged in spying on political organizations. This came out in the Church Committee hearings. And so one of the things that happened was eventually the Justice Department was pressured to adopt something when Attorney General Levy was the Attorney General of the United States, called the Levy Guidelines, which said if the government's going to introduce an infiltrator, a spy, into a political group, they have to have probable cause that the members of that group are engaged in some criminal activity. Well, Ashcroft tore that up, threw it out, got rid of it. At the same time we got those Levy Guidelines established, across the country, people who'd been spied on by the government in a variety of cities went to court and got court orders that their local police couldn't spy on. Since September 11th, those court orders have been torn up, vacated, thrown out. And what's happened as a result? One of the provisions in the Patriot Act, let me find this here. There's a part of the Patriot Act, section 1005, which is called the First Responders Assistance Act. Sounds great. Sounds like we're going to be training people in CPR, first aid, things of that nature. What this section actually provides is $25 million a year in so-called anti-terrorism training grants to be given to local police departments so that they can hire new law enforcement personnel specifically dedicated to intelligence gathering and analysis functions so that they can purchase intelligence equipment, wiretap equipment, pen registers, cameras, computers. And what are the local departments doing with that money? In Chicago, we learned this past February that in 2003 and in 2004, the Chicago Police Department was spying on domestic political groups. Domestic political groups, including the American Friends Service Committee, Quakers. They're not trying to get a nuclear bomb, these Quakers. They're not trying to steal an airplane and fly it into a building. They are protesting the activities of the government, and they are making anti-war appearances, and they are promoting their pacifist belief, and so the Chicago Police Department is spying on them. See, I don't happen to think, and this goes back to first principles, really. I don't happen to think that terrorism, you know, it's very dramatic to get up and talk about thermonuclear bombs, to talk about 9/11, which was certainly a horrible incident. But I don't happen to think terrorism even makes the top 10 list of serious problems in this country. And I think one of the things that has happened is that our entire domestic policy and our entire foreign policy has been captured by a concern about terrorism. I think the fact that a growing percentage of our population is below the poverty line is on the top 10 list. I think the expansion of the low-wage, two-job economy for so many working people in this country is on the top 10 list. I certainly think the fact that there are over 40 million Americans without health insurance is on the top 10 list. I think AIDS is on the top 10 list, so is breast cancer. I think the deteriorating state of public education in this country, particularly in urban communities, makes the top 10 list. I think the continuing cancer of racism and race discrimination makes the top 10 list. I think the fact that there are American children dying of hunger and suffering from malnutrition is one of our top 10 problems. I think the fact that in the last 3 years, our national debt under the current administration has reached such staggering proportions that our children and grandchildren will not be able to pay it off is one of our top 10 problems. I think drugs and gangs and the folly of the war on drugs and the misappropriation of our resources in that direction is one of our top 10 problems. And I think the fact that in the richest country in the world, we have 2 million of our own citizens in prison is one of our top 10 problems. But I don't think terrorism is one of our top 10 problems. I think it's a serious problem. I think people ought to take it seriously. I think we ought to have defenses against terrorism. But I don't think it ought to monopolize our domestic policy and our foreign policy and turn our country into a society of frightened people who are willing to give up their civil liberties voluntarily because the government is playing the politics of fear. Now the question comes, what can we do about it? As was mentioned, I'm the president of the National Lawyers Guild, and the National Lawyers Guild is just issuing a report. We call it the Assault on Free Speech, Public Assembly, and Dissent. And this is a study. I only have this advanced media copy with me tonight, but the book is coming out next week. And if you want to get this book, we're selling this book for $10. But here's a tip. You can download it for free off our website. You don't want to buy the book. But if you'd like to have a nice-looking book, you can go to North River Press, all one word, northriverpress.com, starting next week, and buy the book. Or you can download it from our website, nlg.org. I'm hoping you buy it, but I'm obliged to tell you you can download it. The Assault on Free Speech, Public Assembly, and Dissent, nlg.org. And this is a book about what the government has been doing since the WTO protests in Seattle with regard to mass dissent. It's a book which chronicles the demonization of dissenters through the media. You've seen that for the last 3 or 4 weeks. I don't know how much of it gets into the New Hampshire papers, but if you see the New York papers for the last 3 or 4 weeks, it's been nothing but how the anarchists were going to try to disrupt the Republican National Convention. It existed in Boston before the Democratic National Convention. The demonization of dissent, preemptive strikes, just like we did a preemptive strike in Iraq. The local police departments have been doing preemptive strikes against demonstrators so that they go to their convergence centers and raid them on bogus grounds. Health department shows up, the building inspector shows up, all these people show up, then the police show up. They destroy their puppets that they're planning on using in their demonstrations. They arrest people on bogus charges. During demonstrations, the police have started to arrest our legal observers. I think about 20 legal observers, if not more, have been arrested in New York in the last few days. Legal observers were arrested in Miami. The police are engaging in a variety of tactics to trap people in situations where, on the one hand, they're ordered to disperse, and on the other hand, they can't disperse. In New York, they have these metal devices that they use to trap people in certain locations. This book documents what has been happening in that regard in all these cities, Seattle, Philadelphia, Miami, and Georgia during the G8 conference, even in Boston. And I just want to say a word about Boston and then a word about what we can do about it, and then I'll close and we'll go to the question and answer period. But how many of you had a chance to come down to Boston and see the so-called demonstration zone during the Democratic National Convention? Just a couple. This was something that was incredible, and this is a tactic that we also document in this book. The creation of these so-called free speech zones, which of course is a cruel misnomer, because free speech doesn't take place in zones. Free speech takes place everywhere, right? And you have the right to engage in free speech everywhere, but now the police tactic is to create these special zones. So they created this zone at the Democratic National Convention in Boston, where they had two rows of chain link fences separated by those concrete highway barriers. They had black mesh on one side of the fence. This was separating the demonstrators from the delegates. They had black mesh on one side of the fence that was liquid repellent mesh. Why'd they have that? So you couldn't throw urine on the delegates. Of course, they didn't have any evidence anybody was going to throw urine, but apparently one guy threw urine at the Democratic convention in Los Angeles. So now we have to have this black mesh. Over the top, also black mesh, and on top of that, razor wire running along the length of the demonstration zone. The judge in front of whom we challenged the existence of this zone said the lawyers originally called it an internment camp, and I thought that was just lawyers exaggerating to make a point, but now that I've seen it myself, the judge said, I think that was an understatement. Of course, the judge refused to do anything about it. The judge refused to change anything about it. But even the judge said calling it an internment camp was an understatement. The Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority, the MBTA, that's the transit authority in Boston, announced prior to the convention, about a month, 5 weeks before the convention, that the MBTA was going to start searching bags and packages and briefcases and purses that people carried on the MBTA. Not just during the convention, but that this was going to be a permanent pilot program that the Transportation Safety Authority. The reason I ask that question about unions, you know that the employees of the Transportation Safety Authority are not allowed by federal law to unionize, because Rumsfeld concluded that collective bargaining was incompatible with terrorism defense. But this was supposed to be a pilot program that the Transportation Safety Authority was going to try out in Boston of searching people's bags and packages as they got on the subway. Now, there were over 200 entrances to the subway in Boston. They had four little devices, these wands that you can wave over something to see, and they had four dogs. And they were going to keep us safe on the subway so that no one would bomb the subway in Boston like they did in Madrid by searching all our bags and packages. And we in the National Lawyers Guild and people in the ACLU and people in a variety of organizations in Boston said, we don't want to have to be going through a police checkpoint and getting our bag searched every time we take the subway to work or to school. And we don't want that in our community. And so we started passing out these buttons like the one I have tonight. I do not consent to a search. And we passed them out to everybody who got on the T at the stations that we went to. And the MBTA said, we're going to have a public awareness campaign so that we can instruct the people about why these searches are necessary. And we said, we're going to have a public awareness campaign so that we can instruct the people about why this is bogus and why this is a violation of our rights. Here's the danger that we're in. The danger that we're in is that privacy and freedom, once surrendered, are hard to retain. I know there are people in this room, I'm guessing, I'm not going to say that I think anybody in this room is as old or older than I am, but I have the hunch there are some people in this room who can remember when we used to be able to get on an airplane without going through a magnetometer. When you used to be able to enter a public school by going through any of the doors that the architect had designed for ingress and egress. When you used to be able to go into a courthouse without going through a metal detector. Now, I'm not here to argue that all those things are wrong. But when I made a speech at Suffolk University 5 years ago, and I talked about these things, some of the students said to me, Professor Avery, you're talking about some kind of utopian world that doesn't have these things. I said, no, I'm not talking about, 1 minute, I'm not talking about a utopian world, I'm talking about how I grew up. I'm talking about what this country was like before we started accepting as normal these security measures. If you go to the website of Human Rights First, they've got a report on there that's very interesting reading. It's called The New Normal. Their theory is that all these measures, the Patriot Act, the infiltration of domestic political groups, looking in people's bags and packages, reading your emails, and so on and so forth, are not temporary measures, that this is the new normal. And the problem is that the young people in our society, after a few years, aren't going to know what it was like before we had all these measures. And we're not going to be able to go backwards. Now, is there some risk that a terrorist might blow up the subway in Boston like they did the train in Madrid? Of course there's some risk. Is there probable cause to believe it's going to happen? Do they have a suspect that they've identified that's going to do it? Do they even have a group that they've heard chatter, planning it? No. And I'm not prepared to sacrifice. I'm not prepared to sacrifice all our freedoms over those kind of intangible threats from a problem that I don't even think makes our top 10 list of problems in this country. So what's the point? The point is, you wear these buttons, you stand up for your rights. I've said to some of the people in this room before, your First Amendment rights are like your muscles. If you exercise them, they get stronger. If you sit at home on the couch, they get weaker. So I want to see people out exercising their First Amendment rights. Thank you.
Several questions here. I'm going to start with Mr. Rubega.